This is Talk is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio. This week, a recent environmental film mini festival happened here at the Art House, and I can't thank the Art House enough. If you're not supporting the Eugene Art House here, you should, for all the great programs they have going on over there. And so this is on biologist Peg Herring, a lady who has been working in the forest all her life and painting watercolors and documenting the decline of the forest. And it just shows how important it is for us to save the forest. As soon as we stop the wars, it's more important to save the forest even than to stop the wars. Although they all kind of go together, don't they? So, yeah. And speaking of war, I was listening to Counterspin, plays every Thursday morning at 9:30 on KPW 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, and KPW.org. And so what they're talking about is they had on Inel Shaleen is research fellow for the Middle East at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We hear from her on this week's Counterspin. So this is the end of her interview on Counterspin, talking about Section 224 of the National Defense Authorization Act, and they want you to write your representative and tell them to block or strip Section 224 of the National Defense Authorization Act. So this is from newpolicy.org. Summary of Section 224 of the Chairman's Mark of the NDAA establishes a new U.S.-Israel Defense Technology Cooperation Initiative aimed at accelerating joint research, development, and integration of Israeli origin and jointly developed defense technologies into U.S. military systems and programs of record. It directs the Secretary of Defense to designate an executive to formalize deeper cooperation and integration across emerging and existing domains, including counter-drone systems, missile and air defense, quantum computing, AI and autonomous systems, cyber electronic warfare, direct energy and defense, industrial base co-production, while facilitating pathways from R&D into procurement. This section requires regular reporting to Congress on progress and technology transitions and emphasizes rapid adoption of Israeli defense innovations to strengthen U.S. military capabilities and technological supremacy. As political pressure builds to reduce U.S. military assistance to Israel, Section 224 provides the framework for continuing and expanding U.S.-Israel military ties by entrenching Israeli technology within the U.S. defense supply chain in a way that would shield it from the annual appropriations process. The use of must-pass legislation, as the NDAA has a mechanism of integration, speaks to the plummeting popularity of continuing unconditional support to Israel. The original text of this section is derived from where H.R. 7540 and S. 3855, the Israeli Futures Act, which direct the Department of Defense to formalize deeper cooperation and integration.
This right now, if people are intending to vote for a Democrat in the next election, I think making very clear how significant the need for a new U.S. foreign policy, a new approach to the Middle East, one that is not guided by Israel's interests, but is guided by U.S. interests, is critical. One very particular thing that people could do is regarding that effort to sort of shield the U.S. tax dollars going to Israel from public opposition. The National Defense Authorization Act just was dropped, and Section 224 is a section dedicated to trying to sort of move that money from where it ostensibly has legal oversight from the State Department, moving it into the Pentagon. So if people can call a representative and ask them to block or to strip Section 224 from the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. That is a very concrete action that is doable and would be a very significant way to not allow the Israel lobby to have Americans continue to fund Israel's aggression and murder of innocent people in Gaza and around the region, and to make clear that as a country, we do not want our tax dollars funding that.
I'm going to end on that note, and thank you very much. We've been speaking with Anel Schielein. She's research fellow for the Middle East at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Thank you so much, Anel Schielein, for speaking with us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Raise your hand if you liked it not being so hot today. That was awesome.
Plenty of time for that.
Thank you all for coming tonight. We have a lot of wonderful things planned, and we'll just let people trickle in as they do. But since we have a variety of wonderful things, I wanted to get started sort of on time-ish. I'm Anna, the director of the Eugene Environmental Film Festival. We have Chandra with Oregon Wild. And we have Pat and Deb with Eugene 350 in the back. Those are the organizations we're working with tonight. And then we have, hold on just a second, I made some notes. We have a filmmaker here, and his last name is... Well, he's David, from a force. Simchuk. Hold on. Harris Simchuk.
Nailed it.
Whew. That name.
Easy for you to say.
Being Anna, I get called Anna a lot, so I'm a little, aware of mispronunciations, but... The layout today is going to look like a short session of films that are outside and forest centered. We're going to have Dave, talk about his film and give you an opportunity to ask any questions or shed any thoughts or accolades or appreciations or admirations about his film. And then after I get off the mic, Chandra's gonna come and talk about what's going on forest-wise and what are some ways that we can connect with our representatives, or who can we say what to about forest defense. So we're gonna watch these films, have this juicy Q&A, and then we're gonna go write some letters and mail them. With all of our feelings, and there's going to be some prompts as well about who, what, where, so we'll have a guideline, but if anyone uses any special words, I'm not going to judge. But I'm going to pass it to Chandra. I'm going to skedaddle for a second and find my child. And then come back in here, but I'm going to pass it to Chandra and then let her speak to what Oregon Wild is doing. So thank you guys for being here.
Thanks, Anna. All right, well, yeah, I'm Chandra Legui. I've been working for Oregon Wild here in Eugene for a little over 20 years, which is why so many of you look familiar out there. So I'm really excited to be partnering with the Eugene Environmental Film Festival and 350 Eugene again for tonight's mini film fest focusing on forests, which are a personal favorite ecosystem of mine, as many of you might know. Yours too, yeah, favorite ecosystem, yay! for those I don't know out there, and those of you who aren't super familiar with Oregon Wild, we are a nonprofit environmental advocacy organization that was founded in 1974, right here in Eugene. Michael's like, yep, because I was there. Oregon Wild works statewide to protect and restore the wild lands, wildlife, and waters that make Oregon so special. So across those five decades, I guess technically six decades now, we've successfully fought to protect nearly 2 million acres of wilderness, over 2,000 miles of wild and scenic rivers, countless endangered wildlife, and vast stretches of old growth forests and other essential ecosystems across the state. We have staff, we have members who give us money, we have volunteers, and we have advocates that that agree with what we do. And with all of that help, we advocate for Oregon's ecosystems through education, public communications, direct lobbying, grassroots activism, and we partner, like we are tonight, to elevate allied groups and their voices. So whether it's in the courts or in the court of public opinion, we're here to fight for the wild. Especially, again, favorite ecosystem, the forests that filter our water, store tremendous amounts of carbon, provide homes for wildlife, and offer some of the best places to get outside and fill our souls. And boy, do we have our work cut out for us right now. So it seems like every day the current Trump administration opens up some new threat to nature and to public lands and environmental laws, policies, and agencies that help protect and restore them. It can be really confusing and overwhelming to try to keep track of these attacks. So I apologize if you're trying to keep up. That's what I have to do. It's probably intentional to have all of these attacks being so coordinated. At Oregon Wild, we've worked hard to try to distill information to make it less overwhelming. We have a variety of guides on social media and on our website in like a PDF form, reports and such, to try to spell out these various threats to public lands. Just calling out the attempts to sell them off, to gut protections for endangered species, the efforts to basically dismantle the Forest Service and other land management agencies that we're seeing, and there's tons of actions that have been taken to make it easier to log, mine, and develop the forests and landscapes that we love. In the works right now, there's proposed legislation to fix our forests. It's called that. There's a bill in Congress called Fix Our Forests by logging them more. There are revisions to management plans that could open up mature and old growth forests to aggressive logging. That's including here in Western Oregon under the Northwest Forest Plan and our BLM lands, and also in Eastern Oregon's Blue Mountains. And then there's the proposal to repeal the roadless area conservation rule that protects large wild landscapes across the country from development. Okay, I know that's a lot. I promise I'm not turning the page to get more threat to list more threats. I'm not one to leave you on a down note. So instead, I want to impress on you that there are a lot of ways that we can work to counter these efforts to grab public lands for private gain. In fact, many, many thousands of people have already gotten involved, written comments, pushed back, done all sorts of things. So Oregon Wild and many of our conservation partners, including 350 groups here in Eugene like Cascadia Wildlands, are weighing in on proposals that allow for public comment. They don't all allow for public comment. And we've been helping everyone who cares about these lands also weigh in. So for example, this winter, the Bureau of Land Management announced plans to revise forest management plans on the 2.5 million acres that they manage here in Western Oregon, with the purpose of complying with Trump's maximum logging mandate. The public had just 30 days to comment, and we saw a response to our alerts and to media that came out about it that was far above our expectations. Tens of thousands of public comments were submitted opposing this resolution. This is in part because these are forest lands that are close to where people live. In the Coast Range, in the Cascade Foothills, in Southwest Oregon, they're where we get our water, where we walk our dogs, where we forage for mushrooms. People know these lands. They are our backyard forests. And the proposal said that the agency was going to revisit protections for old growth forests in special areas that were set aside for ecological reasons. And people just did not like to hear that. So we expect a more detailed proposal from the BLM and another public comment period this summer. And I hope that when that happens, you all speak up for threatened places like Alsea Falls and Crabtree Valley and McGowan Creek. Another effort that we have a big say in is defending the roadless area conservation rule, which protects places like Mount June, Iron Mountain, and Joseph Canyon. Since 2001, this rule has kept damaging roads and commercial logging out of remaining wild landscapes across the country, including 2 million acres here in Oregon. And that effort to repeal the policy began last summer, and it just had a short 3-week comment period in the summer over the Labor Day weekend. The Forest Service received 600,000 comments. And you want to know how many of those opposed repealing this rule? 99%. Yeah. People did not like this idea. People liked the roadless rule. It keeps these forests protected from increased logging, keeps roads out that lead to more fire starts, and it maintains drinking water protections and recreation that we all love. So we can expect a public comment period on the roadless rule repeal very soon. Some of you are probably like, didn't we already do that? We thought that the comment period was going to happen in March. And then April, we had a big event over at Gratitude Brewing, if you were there. But they still haven't opened the comment period. So we're still waiting on that, and there'll be another opportunity to weigh in. So, we're urging our congressional representatives to pass legislation that could add protections for wild, roadless lands and waters. We don't have to just sit back and push back against the bad ideas. We can advance good ideas. So the Roadless Area Conservation Act would make the roadless rules protections a law, so it would be harder to overturn. And the River Democracy Act, which was championed by Senator Wyden, would designate over 3,000 miles of Oregon's streams as wild and scenic rivers with protected buffer zones. It's a great bill. We've been working on it for years now. Even if Congress, in all its high functionality, doesn't pass these bills this year, it's still important for our representatives to support them. So after the films tonight, as Anna said, we are going to be writing postcards and letters to our senators and our representative, Representative Hoyle, in Congress. They don't have all the power. People have some power, the administration has some power, but they do have a strong voice. And so they need to hear from people who love nature and public lands and want to see them protected rather than exploited. So please join me in the courtyard, and even if you can't stay for very long, check out the resources and information that we have out there and in the lobby. And thanks again to 350 and to Anna at the Film Festival for having us here tonight, and I really hope you enjoy the films.
Thank you, guys.
Well, I guess I could start. Thank you for everybody coming out tonight, and thanks for putting this on. This has been really great. Just getting people out there learning about these forests. That's basically why I created this film. It's just kind of an introduction to our Northwest forests and a way to kind of point people in the right direction as to how you can make a difference, how you can help out. So that was kind of the hope behind it, and Peg did an amazing job and was just such a great person to kind of share in these forests. So, yeah.
I'm kind of still exploring what I think I want to do. I don't want to work in the environment, but I know you kind of had a change in your career where you kind of started off as like this biologist and then you kind of moved into science communication. I guess I'm just asking kind of both of you, as you've interacted with people, like advice for kind of figuring out your position in this entire movement and kind of like your personal anecdotes of like your experience and kind of suddenly shifting realms in terms of like your environmental work.
The shift came very rapidly for me with the crash of the salmon in the late 1970s. I moved to Oregon in the mid-70s, right out of undergraduate school, and that was when Oregon was Ecotopia. Tom McCall was governor, and he had signs everywhere saying, "Welcome to Oregon, please don't stay," and hordes of us came and hordes of us stayed. So I felt like I had landed in paradise. I had a job as a salmon biologist chasing salmon up and down these beautiful streams in these ancient forests. But it wasn't long until we saw the salmon runs diminishing and the forests getting cut down. And so Ecotopia turned out to be short-lived. And with the crash of the population on our watch, it made me feel like, just like you feel now, you want to do something that makes a difference. And documenting the demise of a species was not my idea of doing something to help. So I switched to science communication.
Yeah, and to follow up, my path is kind of similar to Peg's. I started in the science world, kind of in freshwater ecology, and then saw that there was like a need to communicate the science just because the general public isn't always introduced to it. And so that's kind of how I got into filmmaking and photography. And then I would say in like the last couple of years, just with all the threats that our forests are facing, I've switched more from like just science communication to forest advocacy, freshwater advocacy, trying to push more of the science out there in a way that people can get, you know, understand it and then start to protect these places. So I think, you know, if you're looking for kind of your pathway, science, if you have that background in science, it's a great place to start, and then kind of building on that because you can communicate through lots of different ways. And filmmaking and photography is one, but there's lots of fun ways, like, you know, Peg has shown in the film, that you can share your art and communicate about the importance of these places.
Yeah. I have a question. Beautiful film. Your art just alone and the logs and the journals are so amazing, and the photography is so beautiful. I do have some questions about like where you filmed, but the bigger question right now is, I see you have a book, and we saw it in the film, and so you're communicating, you're writing. And can you tell us about maybe things that you have wrote and maybe other films that you might have worked on?
How do we find out more?
We want more.
This book, Born of Fire and Rain, is an illustrated natural history of our temperate rainforest. It's actually the seventh book that I've written about our area. Two of them are kind of science-y books, and they got me tenure. And four of them are children's books that colleagues of mine who teach in the public schools say, you know, we've got fourth, fifth, sixth graders who we're supposed to teach environmental science. So, you know, we have books about the Amazon and the Great Barrier Reef, but we don't have anything about Oregon. So we started writing books about our own ecosystems. And so that's been fine. But this was the book that I've been wanting to write for a long time because I've been illustrating it for about 50 years. And I thought it needed a few words. And I really started writing for people just like you who love the forest, love being there, but maybe didn't know a whole lot about how really distinctive our part of the Pacific temperate rainforest really is, and how magnificent it was. It rivaled the redwoods, which are the icons of the West Coast now, but while the good people of San Francisco were saving the redwoods in their Save the Redwood League, Weyerhaeuser was cutting down the biggest, oldest Douglas firs in Western Oregon and Western Washington. There's never been a Save the Douglas Fir League. So that was the genesis of this book.
Yeah, and I work for an organization called Freshwaters Illustrated, and we're a nonprofit based out of Corvallis that does media surrounding freshwater, and so we've been around for like around 20 years, so we have lots of films all about freshwater life. And one of the things we like to kind of focus on is celebrating freshwater underwater, so we have a lot of films where we, you know, go in and show these ecosystems from an aquatic perspective. And slowly we're actually shifting, you know, from the aquatic perspective to the forest perspective. And so you saw in Peg's film, there's a lot of connections between forests and rivers and water we drink. So we're trying to make more of those connections. So if you go to freshwatersillustrated.org, there's many films you can find kind of surrounding forests or aquatic ecosystems in the Northwest, but all over the U.S. and some of the work is international as well. So
I have some questions.
Yes, please.
Okay. All right. So I love the science part. I love learning. I love that. That's why I started this festival. I love it so much. But what I also love is the interpersonal aspect of the whole dynamic of filmmaking. I love that part. What was your most happiest moment in filming, both of you, and what was the most sad? Because that part is this too. It's information and it's access to information, but you guys were both there creating that. What was your happiest moment there, and what was the most sad? Yeah, and we're going to write letters about this. We have an outlet if you share Salmon.
Yeah. Salmon. I think it still breaks my heart to watch Salmon beat themselves up against a waterfall and not get over. And that was maybe the saddest part. This was a very joyful project. So it was wonderful to just hang out with Dave and just visit these beautiful forests. And we discovered some really big trees that, on BLM land of all places. So that was a wonderful, wonderful piece. There was something else I was
happy.
Oh, the happiest?
Yeah, most exciting. What was the biggest glimmer?
Seeing it all put together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
without having to edit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I know nothing about filmmaking, so I just watched over his shoulder. But as a science writer and science communication, the hardest lesson I've had to learn is that few people like you love to learn. Most people are convinced by not so much facts as what their heroes believe. And that was a very difficult lesson for me to learn as a fact-based science writer, that my stories really didn't hit all the notes. But when I saw this film and this process of film and these other films as well, I realized how powerful film visual storytelling is. And it's immediate and it's interactive and it invites the experience of the viewer that is more difficult to attain out of just writing. So a joyful piece is, and a hopeful piece is, that we can make a difference, possibly with these films, by engaging people who are just on the fence, maybe a little too busy or a little too confused or not willing to care enough. Maybe this will push them over towards caring.
Yeah, my favorite part was hanging out with Peg in the forest. I mean, you just get Peg in the forest, and I think, you know, just your experience and your knowledge, it was just like you learned so much just being there, hearing her stories, hearing her knowledge. And so it was just, like Peg said, it was a joyful process. We would just find a place in the forest. We would hike around for a few hours and film and photograph. And there were a few areas where, like, you know, with the salmon that I kind of knew, you know, we were going to incorporate those in the story. But really, it was just us enjoying the forest. And I think, like, this whole process and working with folks like Oregon Wild, it's like, that's been the joyful part, is just getting out with people in these forests who are connected with them, learning about their connections and their ideas and their values for the forest. And it, like, builds, you know, the momentum and kind of inspires you to want to do more of this type of work. So yeah, get out in the forest with your friends, with these folks that are trying to protect it, because it's valuable.
Another thing that happened in the 70s was the Hodads.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Could you talk, give your perspective of that work in the context of
the Hodads? I'm not sure everybody knows. That was a cooperative tree planting. They were freaks. They called themselves freaks. They were esprit de corps, owner-operated organization to replant the forest. And at that time, the Forest Service was cutting down trees by the gazillion, so there was a lot of land to be replanted. And it was a joyful group, I think, and really helped set the stage for people caring about the forest. Oddly enough, their work was in clear cuts, and creating plantations, things that we know differently now, but they weren't the ones who were designing the forest management, they were the ones who were implementing it. And it was hard work. You were lugging 100 pounds of seedlings up very steep, recently cut hills, shaved hillsides, just to get these trees in the ground. They were a delightful group, and several of my friends were part of them.
Yeah.
Don't you think that by having that alternative culture involved in replanting, not forests, but plantations, lends some legitimization to clear cutting?
In retrospect, yes, I'm not sure that was top of mind at the time. I think only in retrospect, a lot of us, including me, realized that plantation forestry was an invention of the 20th century.
There's no such thing as plantation forestry.
Pardon me?
There's no such thing as plantation forestry.
I'm sorry.
Plantation forestry. You don't plant a forest.
No, you don't. They're tree farms. You plant tree farms. I will be teaching a class at Oregon State University this fall, and you have to explain what your learning outcomes are for the class. And my learning outcome was one sentence that these students will know the difference between a plantation and a wild forest.
How did you meet Peg? Peg, that was what you go by. How did you connect?
I think I remember I gave a talk at Oregon State University on science communication, and Peg actually asked a question after the talk, and I think it was something like, do you ever make films or photography to like help change? And she connected with another person I work with, Jeremy Monroe, and we all started talking, and this was like maybe a year ago.
Or more,
maybe a little more than a year ago, but I think I gave the talk in March of last year. So. You know, it kind of, our paths collided, and, you know, now we have been on film to kind of share Peg's work and kind of help, you know, get people interested and excited about this forest, so.
Yes, hi. Dave and Peg, thank you all so much for that beautiful film. I found it exceptionally moving, and thanks to Anna and Oregon Wild and for putting on this little film festival. It's, I'm like back being a student now, but I've spent a lot of time doing science communication, and it was inspiring to be like back in to see passionate people tell story I feel really passionately about. So to that end, I was just wondering, maybe because I thought y'all told the story so well, what are your top tips for storytelling? This is what I spend a lot of my time doing, and I think that you guys are, you know, top notch, cream of the crop. What?
Yeah, nailing it.
You go first.
Politics for storytelling. I guess I can just kind of, my approach is like, you know, at least for these Northwest forests, was like show the forests the way that you see them. And so I've spent like the last 4 or 5 years filming forests, trying to find all like the biggest trees, the salamanders, the fish, where is that the most, you know, interesting visual, just to bring this out to the public, because I think, like Peg was saying, a lot of people don't know the difference between a plantation forest or a plantation of tree farm and an old growth forest, because there aren't that many old growth forests. And when I started doing this work, it's really hard to find old growth forests that function like they should. And so that was a lot of it, was just putting in the time, documenting these forests, showing how special they are. And I think that's, for at least my kind of approach to storytelling, it's really just celebrating places, it's celebrating different species, and like really showing what they do, how they act, the science behind them, the behaviors, just all aspects of them, to really kind of introduce audiences to what they might never ever see. I feel fortunate to do the work I do, and I'm able to spend a lot of time in the forest, and so being able to bring that out to the public and share that is kind of my kind of top approach. So.
When I taught science communication at OSU, I didn't have a regular classroom, but I would teach primarily young scientists and faculty members. And my advice was always, just imagine that you're talking to your next door neighbor, which was such bad news for graduate students because they had worked so hard to come up with all of that jargon and that special language and that secret handshake, and they didn't want to talk to their next door neighbor. So, getting them to loosen up, let that stuff go, and trust that the neighbor is interested, but they need to understand the words. The faculty members, on the other hand, would say, why the hell would my next door neighbor care about what I do? And my answer there is, because your next door neighbor pays for it, and you better explain it well. So those two things are, keep in mind as you are writing your science communication, that the people trust your readers. They can understand if you give them the chance. And also reassure the public that this work is not esoteric, that it has a value that is relatable to them personally.
How can we get access to the film to help with distribution or showing it to other people?
Yeah, the film, it's not out to the public yet, but I'm happy to give you a link and a password if you want to share it. And yeah, if there's any ideas, eventually this will be just online for people to access. But right now, we're kind of doing select screenings. So if anybody has ideas for screenings, let me know, because we're looking to do as many as possible.
Thank you.
Let's give another round of applause.
Yeah, so out in the courtyard, there's a table with a bunch of stuff on it, so I'll explain. Normally, at the beginning, I talked a little bit about some processes that the public can weigh in on, like repealing the roadless rule or management plans for the BLM. Those currently don't have an open comment period, so I'm not going to have you write letters on those necessarily. That said, there is information and sort of a comment templates for writing about the roadless rule repeal and some postcards. So you can take those, you can write your comments on what you think about repealing the roadless rule, and then just, you know, send them in when the time comes. It's a good practice. Read through the talking points, craft your comment, maybe write a postcard, and then in a couple weeks, or whenever it happens, you can then mail them in. So,
or we can collect them and mail them. Or there's
we can collect those too. So that's for the roadless rule. We have those materials. But what I think is going to be most productive today is reaching out to our senators and our representative Hoyle. There, as I mentioned, there are some pieces of legislation, some bad, some good, for the forest in Congress right now. So we've got postcards that you can write. So if you just want to be short and succinct, write a postcard, one to Hoyle, one to Wyden, one to Merkley. And I've got sheets out there explaining what you might want to say to them. I don't have all of the talking points with me. For one, we can ask Representative Hoyle to co-sponsor the Roadless Area Conservation Act, which would make the roadless rule protections essentially a law. She's the only Democrat in Oregon who hasn't co-sponsored that bill. So we need to ask her to co-sponsor, it's called ROCA, Roadless Area Conservation Act. Our senators have been supportive of that bill, as well as the River Democracy Act that I mentioned earlier. So you can thank them for supporting protections for roadless areas and wild rivers. But the senators also might be key in blocking passage of this really bad bill called the Fix Our Forests Act. And there's some talking points on the sheet that I have out there about why that bill is bad. And I don't think Senators Wyden and Merkley will vote for it, but they definitely need to know why we oppose it. And so that's a good thing to ask them. So I have materials out there. I also have a QR code on the sheet that everyone can take, so you can go to Oregon Wild and find out more and how to take action and all that good stuff. And then we also have, in addition to the postcards, just sheets of paper so you can write longer letters to our senators or representative if you would like. So we'll come out there and we can chat, you can ask questions, but all those materials are on the table out there. There's clipboards so you can take the stuff to a quiet bench or get a beer. Yeah. and yeah, we'll just come out and collect. We'll collect the postcards and paper and make sure they get to the right place. All right?
John, can you share any resources with us that would help us identify old growth forests?
I wrote this book. No, I also wrote a book, Oregon's Ancient Forest. It's a hiking guide. I didn't bring any copies to sell, but neither did Peg, though. So this is how you can find old growth forests around Oregon, but there's other hiking guides, of course. And
it's a great book.
You've been listening to the Eugene Environmental Film Festival mini-fest from June 3rd, 2026 at the Art House Theater here in Eugene, Oregon. Here in Eugene, we've had a debacle with the police, another debacle with the police, and this time evidence released for another case, the April 30th dust-up at the federal building, there was some footage released during evidence disclosure in that case that showed police making racist statements about activists while driving around in their car, and that officer has since resigned, and now people are up in arms with pitchforks and torches at the Eugene city government, asking for the resignation of the police chief. So you'll hear my testimony in that, and the testimony of the person after me who has a solution to the whole thing. Thanks for supporting independent media.
Hi, I'm Curtis Blankenship, Springfield. I've paid taxes in Lane County since 1985. And I wanted to talk to you about restorative and preventative justice rather than punitive measures, okay? You know, there is no such thing as good or evil. I'm here to tell you that right now. There is only just and unjust. There's only right and wrong. There's no such thing as good and evil. Don't believe me? Ask any woman in this room if a newborn baby is evil, if that baby is evil. And they will tell you no, they are not evil. And so this is why we need restorative justice and non-punitive measures. You know, if they are evil, that means they have brain damage, okay? And they need even more responsibility. Society is even more responsible for these people. People are a product of society.
Thursday
they're not born the way they are.
At 9:30.
So again, I just
KPW.
Want money spent on restorative justice and preventative justice rather than punitive measures. And I need you to explain. Maybe you need to explain this to your constituency. Again, what I've said about good or evil. Ask your religious representatives. They will tell you that no one is born evil. That's not the way it works. So anyway, what else? You know, and I think we've made some progress real quick here. It is the 21st century. You know, in Voltaire's Candide, they used to burn people. They used to roast people alive. So I guess we have made some progress. All right, thank you for your time on this matter.
Thank you, Curtis. Our next speakers are Athena Aguiar, followed by Blair Hickok.
Hello, Mayor, Council. I'm Athena Aguiar, resident of Ward 5. And I was looking at this charter safety payroll tax text, and it talks about how it has to be for a community safety service, which I think is what people were talking about earlier in the work session, about like how it has to be an eligible service. And those are like police, fire, EMS, like 911, jail services, right? But it could be changed to just be like only a CAHOOTS like crisis response service or something like, or like primarily, or do something like that, and then still have these other services in the community safety payroll tax when you guys put it back on the ballot again. So if you, I would request that you would all direct the city staff or do whatever needs to happen to make it so that we can bring back CAHOOTS this way, because it is kind of, my understanding of this is it was intended to be for marginalized communities when it was originally created, and to be kind of like in the vein of alternative response anyways originally. So if it could just be alternative response, I think that would be kind of responsive to what the original premise of the community safety payroll tax was. Thank you for the time.
It's called Whitey on the Moon. And It was inspired by some whiteys on the moon. So I want to give credit where credit is due. All right. That's it.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the Moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night, cause Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. I wonder why he's upping me. Cause Whitey's on the moon? Well, I was already giving him 50 a week and now Whitey's on the moon. Taxes taking my whole damn check. The junkies make me a nervous wreck. The price of food is going up. And as if all that crap wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell and Whitey's on the moon. Was all that money I made last year for Whitey on the moon? How come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon. You know, I just about had my fill of Whitey on the moon. I think I'll send these doctor bills, air mail special. To Whitey on the moon.
This is a song about, this is called the Old African Folktale, because the Old African is talking about this. They said that at the beginning of time, there was a meeting between the seasons, and they all sat down and decided like how long they would go somewhere and how long they would stay and what they would do. They all decided that they would go places and they would stay 3 months and then they would go on to wherever seasons go, and then not where we are. We rarely wonder. Rarely hear somebody say, wonder where spring is or what our fall is doing. We just assume that they'll be back when they're supposed to be. But all of a sudden, one of the seasons was unhappy, clearing it. Fall always stayed too long and spring always came too soon, and so winter was unhappy. And winter decided to stay. Well, under not just stay and count all 90 of its days and all 3 of its months, but stay around and be around and be remembered. A little bit of winter every spring, and a little bit of winter every summer, and a little bit of winter every autumn, and a whole lot of winter all winter long. Winter was the wrong season to disappoint.
Prelude to summertime, that was the time we were waiting for. That was our time. We were out in school.
again.